5 hours, Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The Syrian opposition shows up in Geneva. Representatives of the main opposition group met Sunday with the UN envoy for Syria, Staffan de Mistura, with both sides saying there had been progress in resolving some of the issues that had the opposition threatening to leave before they engaged in proximity talks with Damascus. The opposition is demanding an end to airstrikes on civilians, lifting of sieges that are preventing humanitarian aid from reaching rebel-held areas. In Washington, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry Sunday urged both sides to push for an end to the nearly five-year conflict.
I appeal to both sides to make the most of this moment, to seize the opportunity for serious negotiations, to negotiate in good faith with the goal of making concrete, measurable progress in the days immediately ahead.
In Syria Sunday, the Islamic State claimed responsibility for a triple bombing in a southern Damascus suburb that killed at least 60 people. An African Union summit ended in Ethiopia Sunday with a proposed peacekeeping force for troubled Burundi put on hold after members said they would not send troops without the government's consent. Instead, they'll send a high-level delegation to push for talks between the government and opposition. They'll also seek approval of a peacekeeping presence to end months of simmering political violence.
C'est le cas pour le Burundi, le Soudan du Sud.
AU President Idriss Déby of Chad said the key word is dialogue. He said the AU is seeking peace in both Burundi and South Sudan very quietly. The AU has considered sending a 5,000-member force to stem the political violence in Burundi that erupted last year when President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek a controversial third term. This is VOA News. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu Sunday said if Hamas dares attack Israel through cross-border tunnels from Gaza, Israel will retaliate with force greater than the 2014 war. A top Hamas official boasted Friday the group built twice the number of resistance tunnels built during the Vietnam War. Israeli forces bombarded Hamas and militant Palestinians in Gaza in the summer of 2014 in response to rocket fire. Caucus voters in the Midwestern U.S. state of Iowa gathered to cast ballots late Monday in the first meaningful voting for the next U.S. president from both major U.S. political parties, Republican and Democrat. Peter Brown is assistant director of the National Quinnipiac Polling Service.
Iowa voters, at least 100,000 or more of them, are going to get together with their friends and neighbors in their localities in the same room and state who their favorite candidate for president is, depending on whether they're a Democrat or a Republican. The process is long and it's complicated, and eventually some of those people elected at local caucuses will wind up being selected for national delegates at the end of the process.
There are currently 15 Democrats and Republicans hoping to become the next president, but the Iowa results may force some of those to drop out of the race. The U.S. aid agency has announced nearly $100 million in emergency assistance for Ethiopia to help address the, quote, ongoing humanitarian crisis resulting from the impacts of the El Nino phenomenon, the seasonal warming over the Pacific Ocean that has aggravated the country's drought. Ethiopia's Deputy Prime Minister Dimeke Mekonnen warns the drought is resulting in lives lost and the displacement of many people. He said funds allocated for development are being diverted to food assistance. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon warned Sunday Ethiopia is struggling with its worst drought in 30 years. A new era has dawned in Myanmar with hundreds of newly elected parliamentarians, most from Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy, beginning a new parliamentary session Monday that will install the country's first democratically elected government in more than 50 years. The long-suppressed NLD won 80% of the elected seats contested in November's election, although the military will, under the Constitution, still hold on to 25% of those seats. Europe's police agency says more than 10,000 unaccompanied migrant children have disappeared in the past 2 years. Europol Chief of Staff Brian Donald told Britain's Observer newspaper organized crime rings and sex traffickers may be involved. Even before last year's surge in migrants to Europe, several European agencies documented up to half of unaccompanied children seeking asylum on the continent went missing after registering with state authorities. Serbia's Novak Djokovic won the Australian Open for the sixth time Sunday, defeating Britain's Andy Murray in 3 sets. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Batte in Washington. Today's Monday, the first day of February, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Burundi's opposition criticizes the African Union for not authorizing peacekeeping troops.
There are some presidents of some countries of Africa who are like Nkurunziza, who are dictators, and they can't decide anything because they scare that what they decide is can come into their country.
Jean Minani is the exiled leader of the opposition Front for Democracy in Burundi. Meanwhile, the Burundian government says it is happy with the AU decision. Some Zimbabwean teachers resort to vending to make ends meet. And Uganda's government explains why the army arrested former intelligence chief David Sejusa.
It is unacceptable for a serving military officer to threaten the government, to threaten the democratic process and say we should not go for election. Instead, we should mobilize and take over power by ourselves.
That's Ugandan government spokesman Ofwano Opondo. And Ugandan researchers develop a test to detect the Ebola virus. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's Sports and our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The African Union wrapped up its Heads of State Summit on Sunday without a decisive action on Burundi. Martha van der Wolf reports for VOA from the African Union headquarters in Addis Ababa.
The African Union did not gather enough support during its summit to deploy troops to Burundi without the country's consent. Despite the decision from the AU Peace and Security Council in December to send in troops to halt violence. Peace and Security Commissioner for the African Union, Ismail Shergi, said the continental body will send a high-level delegation to Burundi to continue consultations and the possible deployment.
Pour justement avoir ce dialogue avec le gouvernement sur ces deux points. Le dialogue inclusif.
He says that if Burundi would accept deployment, the force would focus on disarming militia, protecting civilians, facilitate the work of human rights observers, and collect illegally circulating weapons. Burundi's foreign minister, Alanya Mitwe, said the summit ended with a clear understanding the high-level delegation would not focus on deploying troops.
Since the government has several times indicated that we are not in any way interested in that force, I believe that it's clear that that delegation will not engage on the force because we have made our pronouncements very clear and several times.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon told reporters it's basically up to the African Union in consultation with the Burundian government. Assistant Secretary of State Linda Thomas-Greenfield says sending in peacekeepers would be in the interest of the Burundian people.
Our understanding is that this is still under discussion, so I don't think it's off the table, and that's a very good thing. We think it's in the interest of the Burundi government to have peacekeepers that will provide eyewitnesses to what is going on.
Chadian President Idriss Déby closed the summit on Sunday with a call for closer cooperation on terrorism, respecting human rights, and keeping African youth from migrating to Europe through illegal ways. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
The exiled leader of the opposition Front for Democracy in Burundi, also known as FRODEBU, is accusing the African Union and the international community of turning their backs on the people of Burundi, who, he said, are being killed daily by the government of President Pierre Nkurunziza. Jean Minani says if there is a genocide in Burundi, the international community should not say it did not see it coming. He was reacting to the failure of the just-concluded African Union summit to approve a proposed AU peacekeeping force for Burundi. Minani says the AU did not approve the force because there are some African leaders who are dictators, like President Pierre Nkurunziza, and are scared that endorsing a peacekeeping force for Burundi could apply one day to their own countries.
My reaction is that the people of Burundi is killed day by day. International community observes without reaction all those killings of the people. So tomorrow, what do you want to say to them? They fail to take their decision, the good decision. We don't want that if there is a genocide in Burundi, to tell them, don't come to say to the people of Burundi that we didn't know. Everyone knows about the killings, the atrocity committed in Burundi. We say to Africa Union, now they fail because there are some presidents of some countries of Africa who are like Nkurunziza, who are dictators, and they can't decide anything because they scare that what they decide it can come into their country. We say to all the people now, African people, we have to change. We have to tell to our leader, no leader have the right to kill. No one have to assist the killing of people without reaction.
You mentioned if there is a genocide, the African Union will be held responsible. Going into the African Union meeting scenario, one of the opposition coalition said that if the African Union failed to send peacekeepers, that the opposition will resort to armed struggle.
We say peace resolution of our problem is the best way. And until now, we are on this way. We say we want to negotiate all the problem, all the issue of the crisis of Burundi. But if nothing is made, if there are people who take anything to defend their lives, no one have the right to don't use violence when they fail themselves. I scared that civil wars will begin in Burundi soon.
We did talk with the Burundian foreign minister. He said that there is no need to send peacekeepers to Burundi because the Burundian people are trying to solve their problem. Do you think there's still chance for a dialogue?
The dialogue is always a chance to begin because it is a voluntary, a political voluntary. But I think that the government, Burundi government and the Nkurunziza are joking. They joke. So what we say, if they are not the pressure of international community, the pressure of Africa Union, the pressure of East Africa community, Nkurunziza never come in negotiation.
Jaminani is the exiled leader of the opposition Front for Democracy in Burundi, also known as FRODEBU. He was speaking with me from the Rwandan capital, Kigali. The government of Uganda has given explanation for the arrest of General David Sejusa, the country's former intelligence chief and a vocal critic of President Yoweri Museveni. General Sejusa, who has called President Museveni a dictator, was arrested on Sunday in Kampala by the Ugandan People's Defense Forces. This comes as the country prepares for presidential elections on February 18. President Museveni, who has been in power since 1986, is seeking re-election. Government spokesman Ofwano Opondo says General Sejusa was arrested because he has been actively involved in partisan political activities contrary to Ugandan constitution, which he says specifically bars serving military officers from siding with candidates in an election.
First of all, as you know, General Sejusa had run out of Uganda. Then he was given clemency and returned. Nevertheless, it seems he did not learn from his lessons and he has been actively engaged in supporting partisan politics contrary to established law and the constitution of Uganda, which specifically bars serving military officers and men from siding with candidates in election. He has been making public statements threatening to mobilize citizens, first of all, not to participate in the elections because, in his view, the electoral process or the electoral results would be a sham. Now, clearly, that should not be encouraged anywhere in the world. The military is supposed to be subordinate to civilian authority. It is unacceptable for a serving military officer to threaten the government, to threaten the democratic process and say we should not go for election. Instead, we should mobilize and take over power by ourselves.
Mr. Ofwano, first of all, is Uganda a dictatorship or a democracy? And if it's a democracy, doesn't General Sejusa have the right to say what he believes?
He cannot say what he believes if he's a serving military officer, and that is embedded in the law, it is embedded in the constitution. A democracy does not mean you should say anything. There are parameters within which freedom is enjoyed in a democracy. I am very, very sure that a serving military officer in the U.S. cannot threaten President Obama, cannot threaten Congress, cannot threaten the due process of the law or of the elections, and he gets a access to get away with it.
How true is it that General Sejusa was arrested because President Museveni or your government feels he was advising opposition leader Kizza Besigye about the election?
That's absolutely not correct, because what advice was he giving? But even if assuming he was giving advice, is that advice lawful? The bottom line is the laws of Uganda do not permit a serving military officer or man to participate in supporting sides in a political contest, and the law will apply.
Mr. Ofwando, the election is February. Is President Museveni nervous about the possibility that he could lose this election? Because people may interpret the arrest and the other activities as the president being nervous that he might lose.
You can say whatever you want to say. The critics can say whatever they want to say. What is critical is that the law of Uganda must prevail. It is unacceptable for a military officer, it is unacceptable for a civil servant to openly take sides in the electoral contest among political parties, among candidates. I don't think the president is fearful that he's going to lose this election.
That's Ugandan government spokesman Ofwando Opondo. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kampala. Today's Monday, the first day of February, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and still to come, Mark Omar's post and our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day. Please send your comments and opinions to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. Researchers in Uganda say they have developed a new Ebola test kit that detects the virus in minutes. Current tests for Ebola take anywhere from several hours to several days. So Gino Rusbla has more from Kampala on this potential milestone in the fight against the deadly virus.
According to researchers at the Makerere University in Kampala, the new test can detect the virus already in the early stages of exposure. Misaki Wanyagera, leader of the research group, says the test may be able to prevent future outbreaks like the one in West Africa that killed more than 11,000 people.
We want a test that can run throughout the whole spectrum of infection. We don't want a scenario where this gentleman, I forget his name, from Liberia, gets on a plane and finally ends up in Texas. By the time someone develops temperature problems, they are already post 21 days infection. So the test we're developing should be able to capture people even before they develop the symptoms, you know, the fever, the bleeding.
The accuracy of the test has been verified by Grand Challenges Canada, a Canadian government-funded program that promotes health projects in low-income countries. The organization partly funded the research that developed the new test. Babiere Janet Peace, a lab technologist who was part of the rapid test kit's development, says it's very easy to use.
Has a capturing antibody, and then you bring in your sample, and then you bring in your detecting antibody, and then you bring in the substrate to be able to visualize the reaction in case there was one.
So with one drop of blood on a small piece of paper, medical workers will be able to detect if someone has Ebola within hours of initial exposure. One of the biggest challenges with Ebola is that the virus is highly infectious, and with current methods, medical staff often need a laboratory and must carry out elaborate tests. This often proved quite challenging with the virus surfacing in remote forest villages. Wanyagera says the new test breaks down these barriers.
The first index cases that take place for Ebola outbreaks in Equatorial Africa, they happen in remote settings, village settings, where there are no laboratories. So within the remote setting, you need what we call a point of care test. Point of care test is a test which can be done at the point of care outside the laboratory setting. It's easy to use. You do not need a lot of technical training.
It has taken years to develop the new test kit. Initial steps were taken in 2007 after previous smaller outbreaks in Uganda. One of the main challenges for the project was finding sufficient funding. But with the major epidemic in West Africa, donors were more willing to step in and fund the project. Wanyagera says profit cannot be the driving factor when developing medical projects that can save lives.
The model for funding interventions for diseases like Ebola must change. If you leave it only to the pharmaceuticals, they will not deliver, because the pharmaceutical is interested in the profit. If I'm producing a kit that is running cheap, under $5, I mean, ultimately, how do I sustain its production in the sense that the people that are involved in the production, how do I keep paying them so that this is sustained?
A Ugandan firm is currently developing the final test kits from the prototypes. The team is expecting to roll out the new rapid test kits in about 8 months. Serginho Rosblat for VOA News, Kampala.
Some Zimbabwean teachers say they are struggling to make ends meet in a country they say is currently facing serious social and economic problems. Most teachers have resorted to selling various wares in an attempt to supplement their income. Lloyd Moyo of VOA Zimbabwe Service reports from the Manicaland provincial capital.
Teachers are paid almost $500 per month, but some take home about $100 after salary deductions, including loans and credits with the departmental stores and other entities. Realizing that this is affecting their families, some are now engaged in various activities like buying and selling goods in order to supplement their income. Edwin Mukute, who is a teacher at Chiroa Kangwe School in Dangamvura, Sebabo Mutare, says owing to the hard times that have befallen them, most are conducting extra lessons for local students. He says these extra lessons are held over weekends and school holidays, where they charge varying amounts of money.
We as teachers, we are struggling at the moment. We are right now conducting extra lessons, selling vegetables at home to supplement the salary that we are having. Also, we are selling some stuff even at the school where we teach, in the class where we teach. You sell stuff like pencils and other small stuff for the children to buy so that we supplement the small income that we are having.
Another school teacher, Peter Pariani, says he has diversified into selling second-hand clothing and engaging some other income-generating projects. Pariani says there's never a time, especially around now, where a teacher would only rely on their monthly salary to survive.
As you know, that the salaries that we are getting, they are too little to sustain our families and our livelihood. We are engaging into vendor and flea market activities. Like myself, I go to Mozambique. I try to buy second-hand clothes and come and resell. I also take the opportunity when I go to school, I also sell sweets and zip next to students.
Julius Mangezi, a teacher from Chipinge Communal Lanes, says he plays hide-and-seek with school authorities since it is forbidden to sell anything at school. He, too, is now into vending at the school grounds.
What we have now devised is that we are now mostly into vending as a way of trying to supplement our meager salaries. But as you are aware, our school heads do not allow such activities, so we have to do it clandestinely.
The plight of teachers cuts across many civil servants, as they are being paid by the same employer, the government of Zimbabwe. All are crying foul over the deepening economic crisis in the country. This is Lloyd Moyo.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with boxing. Zambian Catherine Peary is the World Boxing Council WBC female bantamweight champion after her sixth-round technical knockout of Mexican defending champion Yasmin Rivas in Tijuana, some 2,900 kilometers northwest of the Mexican capital, Mexico City, on Saturday. Peary is Zambia's first world boxing title holder since the late legend Lotti Mwale, who won the WBC international light heavyweight title in 1990. In handball, hosts Egypt edged Tunisia 21-19 at the Africa Men's Handball Championship final in Cairo on Friday. Angola beat Algeria 24-19 to bag the bronze medal. Cameroon is fifth, followed by Morocco, the Democratic Republic of Congo, the Republic of Congo, Libya, Nigeria, Gabon, and Kenya in that order. Consequently, Egypt has qualified for the Rio de Janeiro Olympics. Tunisia get another chance to qualify for the Olympics at a global tournament in April. Besides, Egypt, Tunisia, and Angola have earned their tickets to the 2017 World Men's Handball Championship in France. In football, Mali edged Tunisia 2-1 in the Orange African Nations Championship quarterfinals at the Amahoro National Stadium in Kigali, Rwanda on Sunday. Guinea pipped Zambia 5-4 in a post-match penalty shootout after a 0-0 deadlock in open play at the Umganda Stadium in Gishenyi, some 160 kilometers northwest of the capital, Kigali. Early on Saturday, Ivory Coast required extra time before they subdued Cameroon Cameroon 3-0 at the Huye Stadium in Butare, some 140 kilometers south of Kigali, and the Democratic Republic of Congo pipped Rwanda 2-1 in extra time at the Amahoro National Stadium. In rugby, hosts New Zealand edged South Africa 24-21 in the cup final at the IRB Sevens Series in Wellington on Sunday. Argentina outplayed Kenya 35-14 in the plate semi-final. As a result, South Africa lead the IRB Series standing after the third leg of the nine-leg series with 54 points. Kenya is 8th with 30 points, while Zimbabwe is 17th with 1 point. Finally, in cricket, Namibia beat South Africa by 2 wickets in Cox's Bazaar as England outplayed Zimbabwe by 129 runs in Chittagong at the ICC Under-19 Cricket World Cup in Bangladesh on Sunday. Earlier on Friday, Namibia dismissed Scotland by 9 wickets as Zimbabwe outclassed Fiji by 7 wickets. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
It's time now for our Black History Month and African History Fact for today, February 1st. On this day in 1926, historian Carter G. Woodson started Negro History Week to focus attention on the contributions that African Americans and Black people everywhere have made to the development of the United States and the world. Later in 1976, Negro History Week was expanded to cover the entire month of February to give more time in celebration of Black history. Also on this day in 1960, 4 Black college students started the sit-in movement at a segregated 5-and-a-dime store in Greensboro, North Carolina, to protest the denial of service. The actions viewed by many historians as one of the biggest events of the early civil rights movement. On this day in 1906, African-American poet, novelist, and playwright Langston Hughes was born in Joplin, Missouri. In his many writings, Hughes documented some of the excitement and disappointment of Black people during the Harlem Renaissance movement. Also on this day in 1978, the first stamp in U.S. Black Heritage Series was issued in honor of Harriet Tubman. Harriet Tubman was a runaway slave who became a legend because of her role in the Underground Railroad, the system by which slaves in the southern part of the United States were led to freedom in the north. And on this day in African history, in 1963, the Federation of Rhodesia and Nyasaland was broken up. Nyasaland, now Malawi, moved towards independence under the leadership of Dr. Hastings Kamuzu Banda and the Nyasaland African National Congress. Those are the Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 1st. We will begin our Black History Month contest tomorrow, February 2nd.
Stand up for your rights.
Lord, Lord.
Get up.
Struggling on.
Don't give up the fight.
Yeah.
We're sick and tired of your ism, schism, game. Dine and go to heaven in the Jesus' name, Lord. We know and we understand. Almighty God is a living man. You can fool some people sometimes, but you can't fool all the people all the time. So now we see the light.
What you gonna
we gonna stand up for,
yeah,
alright.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You better get up.
And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. An African Union summit has ended with a proposed peacekeeping force for troubled Burundi put on hold, as leaders say they will not send in troops without the government's consent. That's it for this Monday, February 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as Sports Editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Charles Holt. I'm James Butt in Washington, hoping you make this week a very productive one.
Tuesday on Health Chat, host Lenore Modu discusses Zika virus. What is it? Who is at risk? How to prevent and treat it? Understanding Zika virus and the current outbreak. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Health Chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.